So welcome everyone to our barbecue Book of Ruth class number 3, the part of the trilogy. You know, trilogies end with the return of the Jedi, with the return of the king, all the good trilogies from history. So hopefully we'll be up to that level. I don't know. The jury's still out. However, that said, I want to express my personal thanks to the Kollel Aharon Valea for their sponsorship of our wonderful learning programs. And again, without them, we wouldn't have the wonderful riposte that we have available to us tonight. So through the eyes of a stranger. So the thesis tonight is the following. This is the theme for the evening. When someone is born into something, it is difficult for the person who is born into it through the act of birth to fully comprehend and understand what it means, perhaps, to wear a crown or to wear a familial heritage. It has to be taught, learned, etc. And it's difficult. If you think about it for a moment, none of us chose mom and dad. Now, some of you might have the honor of being adopted, which means you were actually chosen, which is the highest level of love you can imagine, because you were literally by choice, right? But most of us don't get that choice. We don't get chosen. You literally are the chosen person if you were chosen by somebody. So it's magnificent. So a Jew by choice, a Geret Tzedek, somebody who is what we call a convert to Judaism, is equally magnificent because they are someone who was born from without, outside of Judaism, and they probably fought for their Judaism. Whereas when you're born into something, you didn't have to earn it. Now, Abraham and Sarah, they earned it, but they earned it for all of us who are born into the faith. They went through the trials and tribulations. I mean, Abraham had the Asara Nisyonos, the 10 trials, culminating with the Akedah, the Bani Nevada. So he really earned it, like Smith Barney. Right? Remember John Houseman. They earn it. Abraham and Sarah had to earn it. We are the beneficiaries from what they fought for. So it's a different perspective. So what happens to a person who is living within a world that was already foisted upon them, so to speak? It's hard for us to sort of really appreciate who we are, what we are, where we come from, and the gifts that we have been given in this world. How can we? So tonight, we're going to try to understand how two very unusual people, magnificent people, one, of course, is the heroine, Ruth, of our saga of the Book of Ruth classes, and the other is the father-in-law of Moses, Jethro, who sadly, I guess, was from the Beverly Hillbillies and West Virginia fame, right? Jethro, again, is paradigmatic. Right. Oh, that's true. There's Jethro Tull. Right. Something about it sitting on a park bench. Wasn't that a very famous song? I used to think Jethro Tull was a guy. I didn't realize it was like the big entity. So Jethro, and Rut are paradigmatic of what it means to be a Jew by choice. A Geret Tzedek, a righteous convert to Judaism. So let us now explore psukim verses that I think are the most magnificent in terms of the poetry in all of Tanakh, in all of the 24 books of our written Torah, Tanakh. These verses that I have for you here in source number 1 are just magnificent. Magnificent. There's no other word for it. So I'm going to read them to you in the English, and I'll talk about the Hebrew briefly. Source number 1. And they raised their voices and wept again. So let's contextualize who is the they. What's the pronoun referring to? This is a magnificent moment in Jewish and human history where these three ladies, there's no guys around at all, are on a very desolate, very lonely stretch of land that takes you from Moab on the other side of the Jordan, ostensibly, into Israel, into the promised land. And they're on this journey. For one of them, Naomi, it's her journey home because she left during the famine at the behest of her husband, the now deceased Elimelech, and she's coming home. And it's the middle of the Passover holiday, where they really shouldn't be traveling. And they are so destitute, they don't even have shoes on their feet, according to one of the opinions. And yet they're coming home. Ruth and Orpah are accompanying the aged Naomi. Now, who are Ruth and Orpah? They're her daughters-in-law. Her sons, Mahlon and Kilion, who are all of Shalom, they also died along with Elimelech, the husband. They are gone. But Ruth and Orpah, who are princesses from the family of Moab, could be their father or grandfather, was the very obese King Eglon from the book of Judges that you may have learned about. Ruth and Orpah, not Oprah, please. Not Oprah. So don't play with the names. It's Orpah and Ruth. And they are accompanying Naomi. And they come to a point where Naomi turns to them and dissuades them from continuing the journey home. She says, look, we're going to a place in Israel right now that is xenophobic of the highest order possible. They hate all outsiders. People from Moab, you're going to be hated beyond hate. So don't come. The people will not even talk to you. You're nothing. You're garnished. You're zero. And I, Naomi says, I used to be a princess there. But look at me. I have nothing. I'm empty. I have no prospects for myself. I don't have any young men to offer for you. My children, my sons are dead. My husband, he's dead. God has made me bitter. I have nothing. So go back. You have ancestral Yerusha, an inheritance in your parents' homes. You'll be taken care of. You have trust funds. Go live your life. I love you both dearly. You have been so loyal to me, Naomi says to Ruth and Orpah. Amazing. So I love you both. Please go home. It's for your sake. Do it. Orpah kisses her former mother-in-law, Naomi, goodbye. And there's a lot there. We're not going to go there. A little darkness. But Orpah, her name means Oref, the little nape of your neck, she turns her back on Naomi, and she goes back home to Moab. She, believe it or not, is the great-grandmother of someone you know, Goliath. I will not tell you how that happened, but suffice it to say that she, Orpah, not only leaves Naomi and Ruth behind, but she dedicates the rest of her life to trying to destroy the family of Ruth. So Goliath, as you know, tries to murder King David. And there are other descendants from Orpah who try to kill King David. Very interesting. But that's another story, another class for another day. So what happens? Orpah goes back exactly as Naomi has suggested, never to return. And what does Ruth do? Well, we're told right here. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law Naomi, but Ruth, davka, bah, she cleaved to her. Devek is actually modern Hebrew for glue. Devek, she clung to her. Now, that doesn't mean everyone has this vision, I think artistically I've seen it rendered, where, you know, you see Ruth sort of like hugging her and refusing to. I think that's a little ridiculous. I don't think it was a physical, I think it was more of an emotional cleaving. I'm with you. So Naomi cannot dissuade Ruth in a conventional way. So then what does she do? She explains to Ruth how difficult it's going to be, not just coming back to a place, Beit Lechem, Bethlehem of Judah, where they're xenophobic and they're going to look down on you and spit on you and not even talk to you, have no prospects for marriage, nothing. But beyond that, why do you even want to be Jewish? Do you know what it means to be Jewish? And so we'd only get one side of the equation. We're only privy in this poetry to what Ruth responds to Naomi. The rabbis go ballistic, and they kind of ruin the poetry. So that's why I'm not going to quote it directly. But basically, Naomi starts to say to Ruth, you know how you like to go worship idols and go to those temples of idolatry? That's got to stop if you're going to become Jewish. You know, Jewish people have dietary laws, and you can't be with a man who's not your husband. And she goes through like a litany of halachot, of Jewish laws. that now would be required by a newly converted Ruth to adhere to, hoping to kind of scare Ruth. So Ruth will now second guess herself and maybe join Orpah and go back. So let's just look at the poetry for a moment. So what does Naomi say? Line two. She, Naomi, said, "Lo, your sister-in-law, Ruth, has returned to her people and to her God," lowercase g. "Return after your sister-in-law." And Ruth said, "Do not entreat me to leave you to return from following you." And now the poetry comes in. Magnificent. "For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. So may the Lord do to me, and so may he continue. If anything but death separate me and you." So it's magnificent, magnificent. Again, this is all of Ruth's response to her beloved former mother-in-law, Naomi. Beautiful. Now, we pointed out in one of the earlier classes that who was the ancestor who left Abraham, betrayed Abraham, and never to come home in Abraham's life? It was Lot, L-O-T. Lot is the great-great-grandfather of Ruth. So when she says, "If anything but death, separate me and you." So Abraham said to Lot, "I can't have you not muzzling your animals and committing a desecration of God's name in public, because people look at you, Lot, they see me, Abraham. You're Mimichal Hashem Shemayim. You're desecrating God's name. So you have to start muzzling your sheep. And if you won't muzzle the sheep, if you're stealing from the Canaanites, because this is their land right now, it is not Jewish territory, it'll happen. But that's later in the time of Joshua. Right now the Canaanites rule the roost. So you can't steal from them." And Lot's logic was yes, because it's going to be promised to you, Abraham. And since you have no descendants, you have no child that's going to inherit you except for me, your nephew, your adopted son. So I'll take care of the land. It's mine. And what happens? Abraham says, "If that's the case, separate me from you. You go this way, I'll go that way. You go up, I'll go down." What should Lot's response have been at that moment? "No, I'm never going to leave you, Abraham. You're Abraham. Avraham, I love you. I'm not leaving you." Instead, he said, "Bye. See you later." And he went off to Sodom and Gomorrah. And you know the rest of the story there. So amazing. This moment closes the circle on Lot, who never came back to Abraham, but now his granddaughter, Ruth, is home and says, "I'm not leaving, Naomi. Death alone will separate you from me." So it's magnificent. Now, what is Naomi's response now when she sees that Ruth ain't going home back to Moab? She's coming with her, and there's nothing that she can do to stop Ruth from joining the Jewish people and joining her. So she sees, look at this, the last line. And she, Naomi, saw that, I like the fact they use only pronouns here, I apologize. And she, Naomi, saw that Ruth was determined to go with her. So she stopped speaking to her, meaning to dissuade her. She said, "Okay, you're in. I love you. I want you to be with me. We're going to go together as a team." And they went on. So what does that mean? She stopped. She saw that she was determined. Well, the word in Hebrew, it says, "Vateira," when Naomi sees, "ki mit ametzet hi," fortification, determination. But it's a weird word. It's written, if any of you are experts in Hebrew diktuk, it's a reflexive verb. Good luck with that one. It's reflexive. What it means is, it's reflecting back on the person. So when Naomi sees that not only is Ruth not going away, not going back to Moab, but that as she's speaking to her, in the process of dissuading her, Ruth is getting stronger and stronger in her resolve. At that point, she says, "Okay, I'm with you. I did my due diligence. I told you about what it means to be a Jewish young lady. And you apparently not only can't be dissuaded, but you're getting more resolute. So please, come with me." Now, why is that important? Because this is literally what the rabbis ordained should be done for someone who's a Jew from choice, that you speak to them, and we'll see in a few moments that it parallels the dialogue of Naomi trying to dissuade Ruth, and potentially the rabbis trying to dissuade somebody who is a Jew by choice. Okay, so let's stop for one moment. We're trying to unpackage what it means to be a Jew. The problem, we said at the outset of our talk tonight, is that if you're born into something, it's foisted on you, an act of birth by mom and dad, you don't really understand, I don't really understand, what it means to be a member of the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. How could you possibly understand? You're with inside the Jewish people. You need to see the Jewish people through the eyes of a stranger. That's tonight's title. Through the eyes of someone outside you who will reflect back through their eyes who you really are. Good, bad, or ugly. Hopefully you're the Clint Eastwood guy. You will then appreciate who you are through the one who is coming to be with you. So in other words, Boaz in our story, he says this literally to Ruth. He says, oh my gosh, you think I'm giving you food and you're going to be somehow mechuyev, obligated to me. And therefore there's a dependency that I'm creating. And Boaz, the richest guy, says, no, that's not true. He says, I have seen what it means to be a Jew because of your heroism, Ruth. It's because specifically you and your loyalty and fidelity to Naomi, what you've done to come back from this land to a place where you knew you would be demonized, this xenophobic place of Beit Lechem, yet you were so heroic. You came through your eyes, Boaz says. It has reawakened within me myself. I now understand what it means to be a Jew. So you're my hero. So don't say I'm giving you a little food. There's no mutuality, please. Food costs me nothing, my dear. I'm richer than God. Well, richer than Zuckerberg. And I promise you, a little bit of food is not going to dent my bank account. But what you have given me, Ruth, you've opened my eyes to who I am. Magnificent. So this is the ability that we have to see ourselves through the eyes of a stranger. So Ruth gives us that gift. And who else gives us that gift? Jethro, Yitro. Because Yitro, father-in-law of Moses, literally is described when he leaves, not to return imminently. Moses says, you are our Einayim. You were the eyes for the nations of the world and for us to see ourselves. In other words, Jethro is the Ger Tzedek. He is the Torah's paradigmatic Jew by choice. Whereas Ruth is not in the Torah, she's not in the Chumash, in the five books of Moses, she's in the Holy Writings, the Ketuvim. So the two of them, and by the way, do you notice something in common? They're all in-laws and outlaws. I mean, I make the joke about the outlaw part. But right, everyone's a mechutanim, as we said earlier, right? How? Because everyone's related through in-laws stuff, right? Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. Ruth, Naomi, mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship. Interesting, yeah? Kind of blows up the misconceptions of what it means to have a mother-in-law. These are good mother-in-laws to have. All right, so getting back to our thematic question, that to see ourselves through the eyes of the stranger means that Naomi and Boaz see what it means to be a Jew, and eventually she transforms all of Israel into something different. Whereas when she returns, they spit at her. They don't talk to her. Jew against Jew. By the end of our story of the Megillah, all of a sudden, they're together. She just doesn't transform Naomi, but everybody she touches in her circle, everyone who learns about her heroism, everyone is transformed and shaped by Ruth. We are shaped until this very day and inspired by Ruth. Jethro is the same thing, a little different, because Jethro's he's not quite as warm and fuzzy as Ruth. You know, he's a little bit of a critic of the Jewish people sometimes, a critic of Moses, critical even of God in some limited ways, but not in an offensive way. Why is he the critic? Because Jethro wants to make sure that Jews treat Jews with honor and dignity. And that's the only thing that matters to him. But you know what? That's also what's going on in our story. A lack of honor and dignity. The horrific nature of what Jews were treating Jews like before Naomi and Ruth come back. And what they discovered. It's horrific. So there's a transformation through the eyes of Ruth. Jethro basically says to Moses, it's in your story, I'll cite it to you outside. He comes with his daughter, Moses' wife, Zipporah, and Moses and Zipporah's two beautiful children, Gershom and Eliezer. And they've been away for protection because, Pharaoh, if Yul Brynner found out that he had a family that he could access and hold hostage, we know, unfortunately, now when a person has hostages, it limits your decision-making in a military conflict. So Pharaoh would have gladly taken Zipporah and get Gershom and Eliezer hostage to try to use them as a bargaining chip to prevent Moses, Aaron, and the Jewish people from leaving. So they were in Midian for protection. Now they're finally coming to Mount Sinai. They're coming back to Moses and being reunited. And he's not so sure, Jethro, that Moses is going to honor his old father-in-law. So he basically sends out messengers. Hey, I'm coming to meet you. Are you interested in meeting me? How do you feel about that? So it's all about a relationship. If you don't really want to meet your old father-in-law, what about your wife? Remember Zipporah? You haven't seen her for a while. She's coming with me and your two sons. Maybe you'll come out. And of course, what happens at the end? Moses goes out. And how could Moses not go out with a delegation of the greatest, best, and brightest? Everyone magnificently went out to welcome Jethro. So the fears that Jethro had, that somehow with all the fixation of Judaism, this new nascent religion, on laws, the commandments here and there, that what would get lost? The humanity. And that's what he was hyper-focused on. It's about relationship, which is, of course, what Judaism's about. So Jethro is synonymous. His Parsha, his Torah portion, is where we literally read about the giving of the law, the Ten Commandments, for the first time in the Torah, right in his Parsha. Why? It doesn't even happen chronologically in that order. But it's there to teach us the nature of the true heart of Torah is about brit, covenant, relationship, what I have in my heart between myself and my maker, Hashem, and between ourselves, ben adam l'chavero, interpersonally. And that is prima facie. This is the number one thing we as Jews have to do, is to be together. And that's why we were uniquely united at Sinai in unprecedented ways. So we see ourselves from outside through the eyes of these two strangers, these magnificent people, Jethro and Ruth. And we see how magnificent the Jewish people are. Now, what is amazing is the third source, actually fourth source. This is from Maimonides. How do you go about accepting a convert? So again, this is very brief. We say to the potential convert, and this is bitterly, bitterly true today in perhaps unprecedented ways since before the Holocaust. We say to them, are you crazy? Are you mishuka? Why would you want to become Jewish? Don't you know that these days, this is the bitter pill, I'm sorry, that these days the Jews are belittled, disparaged, scorned, scattered, chased from place to place and suffer affliction? Wow. It's literally what's going on in our world today with the Jew. And if the potential convert to Judaism replies, I know it, and I'm not even worthy to be part of the Jewish people. If only you would accept me. I'm unworthy. We accept him on the spot as a Jew. We then teach him fundamentals of our religion. There's one God, some sample commandments. Such a person can only be attracted with tenderness and warmth. Wow, where did that come from? That's Jethro and Ruth. Because think about it. Ruth and Boaz, it's all about a relationship. Naomi and Ruth, it's all about relationship. Jethro, that's all he's interested in. And he literally says to Moses and the Jewish people, if it's not about relationship, Judaism will not last. It's not real. So that's what Judaism is. It's about how we see each other. What's also equally powerful is that when Ruth is confronted with the difficulties oh my gosh, keeping the Torah, you have to keep 613 rules, you know, all these rules, everything's governed. Oh, it's going to be so hard. What's the Ruth response? Bring it on. And she literally, Naomi's giving her a list, right? Oh, you can't go to your temple. She says, okay, your God's my God. You can't be sequestered with a man who's not married to you. Where you live, I live. Where you lodge, I lodge. She goes, so in other words, she's just batting them back, right? Just pitching. Naomi's throwing 103 mile an hour fastballs, and Ruth is knocking them into, like, so it's like the home run contest, the home run derby on Monday night, you know? Ruth is like Babe Ruth, right? I think he hit about a 650 foot home run right over here in Kingston. He did. He really did in Kirby Park. I think the ball hasn't yet landed, okay? And that was in 1932. He really did. You'll look it up. He really did. He was here. He had a moonshot. I think he hit it off a Jewish guy, too. Kaplan. They're one of the former rabbis here. Yeah, yeah. I think that's when he became the rabbi. All right, so she's like doing the Babe Ruth. She's just knocking it out of the ballpark and saying, Naomi, is that the best you can bring? And at the point where she's getting stronger and stronger, what does Naomi say? All right, I'm done. I'm not having any effect on you at all. You're just knocking all these would-be difficulties out of the ballpark. You're not even interested in them. You're just interested in what? Me and God. Then you're in. Who said that at Mount Sinai? We did, right? God comes to Jewish people and says, you know, I have a gift called a Torah. Oh, do you want a sample chapter? No. You sure? When you buy a book like on Amazon, you can click. And sometimes it gives you like a sample chapter that you could read of the book. So God says to the Jewish people, you know, there's a lot of rules in this big book. You want to hear some of the rules? No. Not one? No. What does it matter? What could it matter? We want you, God. We want a relationship. We want to be your people. Yeah? What would it matter what's in a sample chapter? Because if you wrote it, it's perfect. We love you. We want a relationship. That's what Ruth says to Naomi in response to all these hiccups that might be presented. She doesn't see it as a difficulty. This is what the convert to Judaism says in Maimonides. Like, you're throwing different things at her. You're basically saying, are you nuts? Who would want to be Jewish in such an age of anti-Semitism? And if the person responds, I'm not even worthy to be part of you. If you would only, halavai, that you would accept me. We hug them, kiss them, and welcome them aboard. Kum tachayim. We love you. We want to embrace you. This is the nature of what it means to be a Jew. This is the magnificence that we, who are born into being Jewish, can see what it really means from outside. Now, I want to end with something related to Jerusalem Day, because we're winding down. You speak of magnificence. June of 1967, you have one of the greatest Nisim, one of the greatest miracles of the last hundreds of years, the Six-Day War, where Jerusalem was reunited. That is today, literally right now, okay? This is Jerusalem Day. There was a man, and you've heard of him. And if you haven't heard of him, you'll research him tonight and you'll read his book. He's one of the greatest heroes of the 20th century. Up there with Winston Churchill, in my mind. His name is Anatoly Natan Sharansky. And Natan Sharansky fought against the Soviet Empire for 20 plus years of his life. They beat him and tortured him and threw them into the Gulag in Siberia. And he was unrelenting. He was a Ruth. He was a Yitro. You could throw anything at him. And in 1986, there was a prisoner exchange. And he came to Israel, became a member of the Knesset. He's still alive today. He's an amazing, heroic character. He, in his autobiography, he says that the moment that he wanted in, that he could not live one more moment being a prisoner in the Soviet Union, you know what that moment was? Today. When he heard about the Six-Day War and that God had not forgotten the Jewish people and was there to protect Israel, it was so emotional and impactful that Sharansky recounts, that was the moment that my life meant I needed to leave at any cost to myself. Nothing was beyond my capability. I needed to leave. So again, we can see through the eyes of a Sharansky the magnificence of our Israel. And when there is so much vitriol and venom and Oscar Mayer-worthy baloney that has been nefarious, and I mean this, nefariously, purposefully executed against our beloved Israel, sometimes we need to hear words from without. So I'm going to share with you words from without. And this is in defense of our Israel. And you need to hear this. Okay? And these are words from not a Ruth, and it's not Jethro, and it's not Sharansky. But you understand the purpose. It's not from a Jew. It's from the world's foremost expert in urban guerrilla warfare. I'm going to give you his credentials, because you need to know, before I tell you what he says about Israel, you need to hear this, and you need to take these words into your heart. And anyone who says otherwise, throw a little piece of Oscar Mayer bologna their way. You ready? This is written by a man named John Spencer. Let me tell you who John Spencer is. You'll look him up tonight when you go home. He is an award-winning scholar, professor, author, combat veteran, national security military analyst, and internationally recognized expert and advisor on urban warfare, military strategy, tactics, and other related topics. Considered one of the world's leading experts on urban warfare, which is what Israel is doing in Gaza at this moment, Mr. Spencer served as an advisor to the top four-star general and other senior leaders in the U.S. Army as part of the strategic research groups from the Pentagon to the United States Military Academy. Spencer currently serves as the chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. This is West Point, the Army, okay? And I'm not going to go through, he's been cited everywhere under the world, and he has three books, okay? Listen to what he did for our country before I tell you what he says about Israel. You tell me if he knows his craft. He served over 25 years in the active army as an infantry soldier. He has held ranks from private to sergeant first class, second lieutenant to major, while serving in elite and storied military units from the 75th Ranger Regiment. The Rangers are the Delta Force. They're the highest level of an army. They're like the commandos of the army. Also the Airborne Infantry Division, okay? So listen to what he says. Just listen to these words. This is from somebody from without speaking about our Israel. In their criticism, Israel's opponents are erasing a remarkable, historic, new standard Israel has set. In my long career studying and advising on urban warfare for the United States military, I've never known an army to take such measures to attend to the enemy's civilian population, especially while simultaneously combating the enemy in the very same buildings. In fact, by my analysis, Israel has implemented more precautions to prevent civilian harm than any military in history, above and beyond what international law requires, and more than the United States did in its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that is Israel through the eyes of a stranger. So on Jerusalem Day, let us celebrate who we are, what we are as a people. Amcha Yisrael Goyecha Ba'aretz. We are truly the light unto the nations. Who is like you, O Israel? Goyecha Ba'aretz, one nation apart in this world. Thank you, everyone.